This episode is brought to you by Puttercup. More than a training aid, it's a skill enhancer. Visit puttercupgolf.com and use the code GOLFSMARTER to get 20% off your order. Now, let me explain. We've discussed many training aids on this podcast, and frankly, there have been a lot that have crossed my desk that you never heard me talk about, either because I didn't get it or I thought it wasn't worth your time. But Puttercup is different. After nearly 20 years in the market research industry, Matt Davis, a lifelong golf nut like all of us, had an idea on how he could help every golfer feel more calm and confident when they putt. This isn't a device to improve your mechanics or develop the perfect stroke. Puttercup is designed to strengthen your focus and reduce distracting thoughts while you're putting. How? Puttercups are golf hole inserts that encourage golfers to focus on the putting essentials of speed and aim. They're lightweight and easily fit into your bag so you can fine-tune your focus before every round and at every practice session. Puttercup gives you instant feedback, so it's easy to get dialed in quickly and feel confident as you head to the first tee. You've got to check it out for yourself. Go to puttercupgolf.com and use code GOLFSMARTER to get 20% off your order. And combined with the 15% discount you get with the Pressure Putt Combo, you really save. And the Pressure Putt Combo includes both the Speed Bump and the Center Cup, two very different but very valuable skill enhancers. That's puttercupgolf.com and get 20% off your next order with promo code GOLFSMARTER. This episode is brought to you by Modern Mammals, a company that creates new hair washing products for men. Visit modernmammals.com and use code GOLFSMARTER for 10% off. I'm a guy. I get it. Once you find a product you like, especially hair care products, you think, that's it. I'm not changing. Why would I? This works fine. Really? Fine? When is fine good enough in your life, your work, your game? Unlike the shampoo you've been using forever, Modern Mammals products don't have harsh detergents that suds up and dry out your head and hair. And unlike conditioners, they don't leave your hair limp and frizzy. Instead, they lightly clean your hair and scalp, cleansing your hair while protecting its strength and texture. But let's get back to you. Have you ever really cared about what you put in your hair? Probably not. But that's why you need to visit modernmammals.com and read the reviews that prove how well it works. And while you're there, use code GOLFSMARTER at checkout for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with the promo code GOLFSMARTER. That way, they knew we sent you.
For members only. Golf Smarter number 436 and 437 published on May 13, 2014.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
A Difficult Par, biography of Robert Trent Jones Sr. and the making of modern golf.
This is Golf Smarter.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter podcast, Jim.
Thank you very much, Fred. It's a pleasure to be with you on this podcast.
Thank you. I got a book in the mail from your publisher with your name on it, and I love the title of it, especially when I was reading what it meant. So why don't we just start with that? The book is called A Difficult Par. Where did that come from?
Well, literally, it comes from the basic principle that Robert Trent Jones Sr. followed in the design of his golf courses, really from the very start of his career to the end. And that was the idea that every good hole should be a difficult par, but an easy bogey. So that was kind of the ruling architectural principle for him. And I thought not only was it a mainstay of his architectural strategy, but I thought the title also, in a more metaphorical way, conveyed some other aspects of his career, because he had lots of ups and downs, and was an immigrant boy that that had big ambitions, and so it's really a uniquely American dream kind of story. And so the difficult par conveys, I hope, more than just the architectural principle.
And why did you pick, I looked at the other titles that you've written, and I was kind of baffled. Tell us about the other books that you've done. Let you do the talking on that one.
Yeah, well, my career, you know, I'm an academic historian. I teach history at Auburn University here in Alabama, and I specialize really in the history of science and technology, and I've written most of my books on the history of aeronautics or the history of the space program.
Right.
My one previous biography was biography of Neil Armstrong, which I guess is the book I'm best known for. And but I always wanted to do something. I wanted to do at least one book on golf because, you know, I grew up playing golf from the time I was 9 or 10. I worked at a golf course from that same age all the way through college. I played college golf. Cool. You know, I've always loved the game, and I wasn't good enough to really play in any kind of significant way. And but I wanted to do something, for a sport that I love so much. And I got this idea to do a Jones book, probably in part because I lived in Alabama, and in the early 1990s, the Robert Trent Jones Trail was being built all over the state. And that, I think, kind of that converged with just my overall interest in the game of golf and my interest in doing a biography. And I actually contacted Mr. Jones when he was still living down in South Florida. I wrote a letter to him, and I got a letter back from his lawyer saying that Mr. Jones wanted to do his own autobiography. That never worked out. And then he died in the year 2000. And by that point in time, I was on to the Neil Armstrong biography. But as soon as that was published in 2005, I got serious again, and I had to overcome a number of challenges related to the records of Mr. Jones and to the two sons of Mr. Jones, both of whom were prominent golf course architects. But yeah, it's strange that I would go to this topic, but if you know my own biographical story and the loves of my life, which one of which is golf, it's something I've really wanted to do for a long time.
Are you going to do biographies on your wife and children? You're talking about doing stories on the love of your life.
Do that. And in fact, I hope no one ever does a biography of me, and not that they would. But, you know, one of the amazing things about this particular biography is that I had access to really carte blanche all of Jones's papers, personal and business, even his love letters to his wife-to-be that he wrote in the early 1930s in the midst of the Depression when he was trying to get his career started and, you know, wasn't getting jobs or wasn't getting paid for the jobs that he did do. And so I had, you know, amazing access to all of his records. And, you know, you don't usually, when you get into somebody's archives, usually, you know, they've pulled out a bunch of stuff that they don't want you to see. But in this case, there was the sons of Mr. Jones just let all that material go to Cornell University without any kind of, censorship or restrictions. And so when I got into that archive, which was by special permission of Robert Trent Jones Jr. initially, I mean, it was really sort of an intact file. The boxes were basically the filing cabinet drawers that had been Mr. Jones's records for 70 years.
Of all the characters that have come across and walked across a green, why Robert Trent Jones Sr.?
Yeah, well,
there's so many great characters.
Yeah.
And I mean, I understand everything was uphill battle for him, including that love affair before he got married. That was a strong uphill battle. And even becoming a golf course architect, from the way you describe it, everything was an uphill battle for him. But was he that compelling of a human being?
Well, it got easier for him because by the 1950s, when he was becoming known as the open doctor for his renovation of championship courses, you know, mostly for the U.S. Open, but then for some of the other majors, notably the PGA, it got easier for him, and he got so successful and so prolific that it became kind of a challenge just to keep up with all of his projects because he was really considered to be the world's foremost golf architect at that point. My choice of Jones was really based on, it was partly instinct and partly I was pretty sure I had the information about this correct. I just didn't think there was anybody in American golf, and that includes all the professionals. I didn't think there was anyone where you could tell more about the history of the American golf course and about American golf generally, and for that matter, worldwide golf, than Jones. Because, you know, here's someone that worked as an architect from 1930, from Calvin Coolidge to 2000, you know, to George Bush. So, I mean, he had this very, very long career, and he designed golf courses, you know, in 43 different states of the United States, and Puerto Rico, on five different continents. He was certainly recognized. I mean, he really made golf architecture as a profession what it was, because, I mean, not that there weren't very talented, maybe even, you know, one could certainly argue that there were even better architects, and McKinsey or Donald Ross or someone, but they weren't really household names. The name of the architect was not really what we think of today. We always know we're playing a Ross course or a Pete Dye course or whatever, but golfers didn't think that way. Prior to Robert Trent Jones, he was the first brand name in golf, and he was part P.T. Barnum and part Alfred Hitchcock. I mean, he was this really ambitious character. He was a great pitch man. He wasn't really a great businessman, as the book points out. His wife, Ione, who he married in 1934, she was a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Wells College, and she was smarter than heck, and she really kind of ran the business operation for Jones for most of his life. And without her, you know, he probably would have failed. But he was just very, very good at convincing people that they should build golf courses. And he got to know, by telling his story, you're telling the story of most of the well-to-do gentlemen of American society who got involved in golf course development. Everyone from Lawrence Rockefeller, who was building golf courses at some of his major resorts around the world, including Mauna Kea in Hawaii, which became one of Jones's more prominent golf courses. Jones had correspondence with Bobby Jones and a close friendship with Gene Saracen. He corresponded regularly with Francis Ouimet. Of course, you know, his courses in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you know, he's having interactions with Ben Hogan and Palmer and Nicklaus. So I really went into it thinking that there was, by telling Jones's story and using that as the skeleton of the narrative, that you could really tell so many different stories about the development of American golf. And I think that, in fact, you know, proved to be the case.
Yeah, I don't think you definitely know when you're on a golf course who it was. I mean, sure, there's a couple of names, but, you know, like when you talk about baseball or basketball, there's a couple of names, you know, but then there's everybody else, right? You know, you don't know when you're on a Robin Nelson course or a Brad Brewer course. And why would you, right? It's never the first course. But when they're famous courses and resorts you're going to, it's like they market that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that started with Robert Trent Jones.
Uh-huh.
The brand name of the architect merely meant virtually nothing in the marketing of the golf course, or the promotion of the golf course to the public, until Jones after World War II. And then it becomes, you know, he sort of sets the standard that made it possible. I mean, now when we think about the great designers who were really, really popular, I mean, you're thinking about Nicklaus and Fazio and Tom Doak and Coore and Crenshaw and Gil Hans. None of those guys, honestly, could have had the careers they've had if not for Robert Trent Jones, because he created the profession and the model by which they would be successful, you know, certainly financially, because he started to get major fees, you know, up to, you know, he was the first to get $1 million fee for a golf course design. Before then, I mean, even though Ross and McKenzie were much in demand, you know, they didn't get paid anything like Jones would get, because Jones created that profession.
It was fascinating to me, and answer me if I'm right in assuming this, but it seemed like the Depression helped get him going.
Yeah, absolutely. The New Deal that Franklin Roosevelt started, you know, besides supporting through with public money and public relief work, I mean, people that were unemployed were put to work building roads and
right.
Building
the parks. WPA, right?
WPA, Works Progress Administration. The first money that Jones really started to make as a golf course designer was in the state of New York, involved with WPA programs. There were a number of WPA courses that were built around the country. I mean, Jones did a couple in New York. He did one in Florida. He did one in Illinois. And those jobs paid.
I mean, the government was behind them, whereas the jobs, the few jobs that he had gotten between, say, 1930 and 1935, they were private jobs, and, you know, he was getting stiffed on most of his bills. I mean, he was, the book will show, and based on the correspondence and his business records, I mean, this guy's living almost the life of a pauper. He's going into a coffee shop and ordering, the cheapest bowl of soup and the glass of water. I mean, he's not making any money whatsoever. And the wife-to-be, Ione Taft Davis, who was this debutante from New York City, completely different social class than what Jones grew up. He was an immigrant family. He didn't even have a high school degree. Ione's father, who was an executive at Bell Telephone in New York City, wouldn't let his precious little princess marry this, Robert Jones. This immigrant, until he could prove he could make some money. So the WPA really is what lifts him, into. So it's government, it's state-supported money that gets him going. And then the great irony of it is the end of his career, after a number of very significant bad investments, which really bankrupted Jones in the late 80s, in the early 1990s, what comes along for him and saves his bacon? The Robert Trent Jones Trail, which is financed by a state retirement system. So on the front end of his career, it's state money, and on the back end of his career, it's state money. But in between, he had a roller coaster ride through all kinds of different projects, public and private.
I have a dream to go do the Robert Trent Jones Trail. It's hard for me to convince any of my friends to go with me. Coming from the West Coast, have you played those courses? Have you played the trail?
Absolutely. There's a few of them that I've not been on, but there's a Robert Trent Jones Society, a group of clubs that Jones designs that have come together in the past 5 or 6 years for an annual meeting, and they go to different Jones courses and they play for a few days. And last year the society decided to come to Alabama. And many of these members of the Robert Jones Society had never even been in Alabama before, I don't think. Mm-hmm. And they played a couple different facilities here in the state. And the reaction was really, they couldn't believe what they were seeing. Mm-hmm. Prices and everything. The state of Alabama, some of the stereotype is correct. I've lived in the state now for 26 years. I grew up in Indiana. So some of the stereotypes are correct, but many of them are not. And as in terms of the natural beauty and the environment itself, to go from the Appalachians in northeast Alabama all the way down to the Gulf Coast, the Mobile area, and in between there's big rivers, lakes, rolling terrain, and that's what makes the trail so interesting. The designs are very common. They're all Jones-style designs. But the terrain, the topography, because these facilities go from top to bottom in the state, the gland itself dictates a lot about golf course design everywhere, and it certainly does in the trail. So, yeah, you need to convince your friends to come down here.
If I get a long weekend and we get a chance to play 3 or 4 of the courses there, which ones would you recommend? Because I'm taking notes.
Well, I'm biased. I live in Auburn, and nearby our sister city is Opelika, and the Grand National facility, which almost all of the facilities are 54 holes. There's two 18-hole courses, and then a short course. And the short courses are, the short course at Grand National is the hardest par 3 course you'll ever want to play.
Really?
The holes are, everything from, from 150 to 250 in distance, and it's all around this lake and carries and bunk. It's a really, really difficult short course. But I would come to Auburn. We're only an hour and 15 minutes from Atlanta, so you can, from the Atlanta airport. So you can fly into Atlanta, get over here to Auburn real easily, and then perhaps drive over a 50-minute drive from Auburn over to Montgomery. Just north of Montgomery is a little town called Prattville, and Prattville has a 54-hole facility called the Capitol. And it's kind of the home base of the trail, since the retirement systems of Alabama is located in Montgomery. So I would do that if you only had 2 or 3 days.
But if you were talking to people from Montgomery, they would say for you to come to Montgomery because there's two trail facilities right there. There's Ross Bridge that has hosted a senior open, a senior event for many years. And then there's Oxmoor Valley as well. And then Birmingham itself has, Birmingham has some great golf. The Birmingham Country Club has Donald Ross courses. Of course, there's the Nicholas course that, that has hosted a PGA. So Alabama's got a lot of great golf. And fortunately, we get to play pretty much year-round except for, you know, except for maybe a few weeks in the middle of winter when it gets a little too cold or we get a dusting of snow.
But what about spring, summer, fall? Which would be the best time to come?
Fall, without question, fall. And then you can also benefit from SEC football. You can we'll get you to a you know an Auburn football game or an Alabama game, and you'll see what SEC football is all about. I went to Ohio State for graduate school, so I know. You know, I know what Big Ten football is, and I know it's very popular, and you know it's got a lot of fanatics. But SEC football is such pageantry; I don't think there's anything compared to it. So, if you came down in the fall, sometime in October, and we could get you at a night game, say LSU at Auburn, you'd have a. And we did that when the Robert Trent Jones Society people came, and I can tell you, to a man, these gentlemen. They talked as much about going to that football game as they did playing the golf courses.
Awesome. I'm gonna get in touch with you before we come down, and you're coming with us.
Absolutely. Let me know.
That would be great. That would be so much fun. So I'm curious. Did you in writing this book and choosing him, did you like him more before you started writing the book or after you started writing the book?
That's a really good and tough question for me to answer because I think anyone who reads it will know that I've given a kind of a warts and all profile of Mr. Jones.
Uh-huh.
He's not a perfect person, not who is, but he is.
Well, but he would tell you he is.
Yeah, he might.
I got the sense his ego is enormous.
Yeah.
And I met Junior, and his ego was filled the room too.
Yeah, well, I think maybe even more so than the dad in that case.
Yeah.
But no, I honestly like Jones a lot. I mean, when I live the life of Jones when I write the book. You know, that's just kind of what the biographer has to do. You live the life of the person, and there are times when you regret decisions that he made or did not make. And I could go through. You know, some of them are mistakes that he made in terms of business investments. You know, some were mistakes, and the ones that bothered me the most were things that had to do with, you know, with personal issues. I mean, the early on, for example, his career got started because he became an associate of a Canadian architect by the name of Stanley Thompson, very prominent, probably the most prominent Canadian architect, and one of the great architects really ever in the world. And Jones, as a young man, because he didn't have any credentials, the clubs that were interested in maybe using Jones wanted to have somebody with experience looking over Jones's shoulder at least. And so Jones went into a partnership with Stanley Thompson, you know, as soon as he went into business in 1930. And Thompson really treated him like a son and gave him a lot of business. And then there came a time after Jones, you know, was getting these jobs through the New Deal money and all of that, when Thompson wanted Jones's help, wanted him to come down to South America to help him do some work down there. And it seems like Jones kind of committed to doing that. And then he didn't do it. And he kind of, you know, when he needed Thompson, he used him. And then when he didn't need him, he kind of ignored him, you know. And so there were certain things that happened, you know, in that way as a biographer, you know, living the life of the person that you're studying, where you say, why are you doing that? You know, go ahead and do that. You had promised Stanley you were going to Brazil, and now you're copping out on it, you know? So you do things like that. But in the end, I mean, I certainly admire what he did and have greater appreciation for what it takes to design and build golf courses. I learned a lot about the processes of that. And do I like him any more or less? I think I probably have to say I value him more because I have a greater, deeper understanding of the man and what motivated him. And, you know, I certainly I can tell you one thing may seem a little strange, but I played the Cornell course that he designed. I played by myself one evening when I was doing archival research, and I sneaked out, and I think I was the only one in the course. It was kind of raining. And I kind of pretended I was playing the golf with Robert Trent Jones. It was his golf course. And, you know, I was kind of just in my mind imagining what kind of conversation I would have, what he would tell me about this hole or that bunker. And so you do sort of develop kind of this personal relationship with the person you're studying, because you just know, you know, there's not much about them that you don't know. And through my oral interviews, I, you know, had long interviews with both of his sons and with other people that worked for him, and with had all those love letters, and I had all long interviews with the man who was his personal physician for many years. So you just really get to know the person. And I'd have a hard time writing a biography of somebody that I just detested. I mean, like, I couldn't imagine writing Adolf Hitler's biography. There have been a bunch of them, so we don't need one of those. But I don't think I could write one of someone that I just totally despise. And that's certainly not the case with Mr. Jones. I find him, you know, very endearing. I just I regret some of the foibles in his personality and some of the choices that he made. But you know, if someone did my biography, they'd find even more to complain about.
Well, you know, the prolific and very successful biographer Doris Kearns Goodwin has said that she feels like she has to go to bed and wake up with this person. You like you said, you just live your life with this person. And so there are presidents, you know, that were her topic. Mm-hmm. Their presence that she just doesn't want to go near because she just doesn't think she could go to bed with them every night.
Yeah, you do. And they keep you up, you know, they keep you from going to bed too. I mean, the working habits, you know, I become very obsessive when I'm writing a book, and my family, I mean, my family just, so I'm almost impossible because everything I'm talking about, I'm just constantly thinking about the character that I'm writing about, and I want to share in, you know, what I'm learning, and they, you know, and fortunately I have a family that's been very supportive, but you know, at times I'm sure they just get, Dad, you've got to, you know, you're going on too long. Let's move on to another topic, please.
Enough about him. What about me? You mentioned he didn't have credentials before he started working with Stanley Thompson. Mm-hmm. I mean, he wasn't very well educated, if at all. No. He didn't go to college. He didn't have it.
No,
but he was able to convince Cornell to start a program to teach him how to do this. I mean, he really was focused on wanting to be a golf course architect.
Absolutely. And it wasn't that they convinced them to start a program. It was basically that just they would give him special admission status to take just those courses that he thought he might need, you know, some agronomy, some landscape architecture, some business courses, some public speaking was a course he thought he needed to take. So he took 2 years of courses. And the way that it worked out, because remember, here's a guy that doesn't have a high school degree. How does he get into an Ivy League school like Cornell? And the way it happened, and this is what golf can do for people, Jones had, as a young man in his early 20s, got a position up at Sodus Bay on Lake Ontario, a little golf course there. And one of the members at Sodus Bay was a man named James Bashford, who was the owner of a vinegar factory. And he was kind of a wealthy man, and he had been a Cornell graduate. Well, it just so happens that, you know, Jones, as the club pro and manager of this course at Sodus Bay, he befriends Mr. Bashford, tells Mr. Bashford about his interests, and Mr. Bashford, you know, being a wealthy and influential person and a Cornell grad, said, well, let's see what I can do for you. So he takes Jones down to Ithaca in his limousine and has an appointment made with the Dean of Agriculture, and it's really through Bashford's intercession that Jones is permitted to do this. And Jones learns from that. I mean, maybe he knew it even before, but throughout his career, Jones cultivates friendships with powerful people. I mean, in the state of New York, when he's working on these WPA projects, he needs to have James Evans, and he needs to have Robert Moses, the central figures in the New York State park system. He needs to have them on his side to give him these jobs. So he very consciously goes about cultivating friendships with with powerful people. It's going to be, I mean, all through his career, you can just make a long, long list of the important people that Jones cultivates friendships with, because it all started with James Bashford taking this young guy down to Cornell and getting him into some courses that he would never have gotten in on his own.
Clearly the man was opportunistic, and we've already covered the egotistic part. What kind of family man was he? What was his family life like?
He was kind of an absentee landlord. He was gone. I mean, by the boys were born in 1939, Robertson Jones Jr. in 39 and Reese Jones in 41. And Jones's career really picks up, you know, in the post-World War II period. And by the early 50s, when the boys are just turning into their teens, he's everywhere. I mean, he's designing 20 different courses a year in different parts of the country. And then, you know, before long, he's off into the Caribbean and then points beyond. So he's not home very much, honestly. And the task of raising the boys really fell to his wife, Ione. And Jones, when he was home, you know, he would be, golf was always kind of part of it. You know, he would take the boys to the driving range in the evening, or if they were having a family vacation, it would really be down to a work site. If he was working on a course at Myrtle Beach or, you know, down in Florida, you know, the family would jump in the car with him, but he would still be basically working. So, you know, not a father that was, you know, really hands-on very much with his boys. And the whole issue of the feud that develops between the two sons, and it gets very, very, and it still is, it's something that will never get resolved. And the book sort of goes into some of the issues of how this family sort of becomes dysfunctional. Jones not being there, not being hands-on, I think is part of the explanation for that. I don't think he was a bad father. I think he was just like a lot of fathers, maybe of that generation in particular, where career was put first and his love of golf was put first and his, you know, ambitions, which required all kinds of travel. The boys just, you know, they just sort of grew up, you know, on their own with their mother. But then they went to work for their dad.
Yeah, it's, you know, like how did it get to the point where they're both going, that's what I want to do, Dad? You know,
yeah,
that's amazing to me that if they don't have a close relationship and he's an absentee guy, that they still see this as glamorous enough to, I want to go do that too.
Yeah, it is. That is a very interesting issue. I think for the oldest son, it's maybe a little bit easier to understand. He is the namesake. He's Robert Trent Jones Jr. Mm-hmm. He's quite a good golfer as a boy. He plays in a lot of tournament events and plays high school golf on a championship team and goes to Yale and plays on the Yale team. So he's and the two boys in 54, when the Open was played at Baltusrol, Jones took the two boys as teenagers. And one thing that Jones did, which was unprecedented, you know, for the USGA at the time, was he was keeping track of driving distances for the pros, very systematic measurements and records kept of how far the pros were driving the ball, because Jones wanted to know when he was remodeling a course or designing a new one where those fairway bunkers needed to be. You know, if they some of the old classic courses of Ross, for example, or Tillinghast, the bunkers might have been out between 200 and 220. Well, you know, all the pros were driving over that. And so when Jones came in to redo the courses, he had to have measurements. Well, he would take the boys along and they would sort of chase the balls down for him. You know, they were allowed inside the ropes when ropes were first used, I think, which was at Baltusrol. And so the boys, you know, they got to see, they were taken to the Masters a couple of times. So they got to experience golf at a very high level. But Bobby wasn't, you know, the oldest wasn't planning to be a golf architect. He went to law school at Stanford, and, you know, his version is that he kind of lost interest in law. And another version might be that he flunked out. But he decided at that point that he was going to, you know, that he was going to go to work for his dad, but not on the East Coast where the Jones operation was based, which was in Montclair, New Jersey, but he was going to stay out in California and create a West Coast office in Palo Alto, which is what he did. And it didn't take long for Jones Jr. to sort of go his own way. You know, he learned it from his dad. but he, you know, he wanted to be out on his own. And the book goes into some detail about the process by which Bobby, you know, uses this West Coast office, which was ostensibly to be, you know, an expansion of Robert Trent Jones, Inc., the parent company, while Bob goes on to use that base to create his own, you know, his own company. Reese is the more interesting question, you know, the younger brother. Why would the younger brother, who's having, you know, issues with the older brother, why would he try to become a golf architect too? I mean, I have an older brother, and the last thing I tried to do when I grew up is be, you know, I needed to do something very different from him.
Absolutely. Same for me.
But Reese wasn't like that. In fact, Reese, honestly, he had the idea of being a golf course architect probably before Bobby did. And because when he went, after he graduated from Yale, he decided to go into a landscape architecture program at Harvard, which he did. And so he was intending, even I saw his letter when he was applying for college, and he was talking to a golf course architect and following his father's footsteps even then. So Reese kind of has decided to do this even before Bob. But Bob, you know, because things didn't work out with the law, Bob decides, well, and he's got the name after all. I mean, he's right there with Robert Trent Jones. So he decides that that's the best career for him as well.
Are there three distinct different styles between the Joneses on their design work?
Well, that's really a great question. I think that, you know, I've played a number of all three, and there's certainly some things in common between the father and the two sons. But there are also some clear distinctions, and there's some clear distinctions between Reese and Bobby. I think Bobby, you know, is you know, probably he's less into doing the championship courses, although he did in Chambers Bay out in Puget Sound, Washington. You know, it's going to host the Open in a couple of years, and so it's not that he's uninterested in championship designs. But Reese, you know, kind of took on the mantle of his father, the Open doctor, and has been used by the USGA and the PGA, you know, a number of times to redo championship courses. One thing that's real interesting about Reese's courses, the redesigns that he does of his dad's, is that he changes his dad's courses in some pretty significant ways. And when the father was still living, there's some correspondence, for example, about Congressional that Mr. Jones had redesigned back in the 60s. And then Reese comes in and does a couple, you know, major remodelings at Congressional in the 80s and 90s. That when Mr. Jones is still living, he's writing letters to Reese kind of complaining about what Reese is doing to his courses.
Wow.
You know? And so there is, you know, Bobby suspects, I don't really take it quite this far, but, you know, Bobby suspects that Reese was sort of consciously or unconsciously undoing some of his dad's designs, you know, that he wanted them different. He wanted them to change. He wanted them to be distinctive of his own style. And I think there is some truth to that. So yeah, you can tell the differences between the three, but there are also some similarities as well, because they all kind of learned. I mean, the boy learned a lot about course design, not just from their dad, but from the men who were in charge of building Jones's golf courses. A man by the name of John Schmeiser, and Bill Baldwin. And since the boys didn't want to listen to the dad that much, that wasn't especially true in the case of Reese. The father put his construction foreman in charge of basically showing Reese and Bobby how you build golf courses. And so they learn, you know, the logistics and the nuts and bolts of golf course construction really from the same people. And that meant a lot of carryover.
So then what happened between the two brothers?
Well, it goes back to their boyhood. I would have to be a professional psychologist really to explain what it is. I think Bobby, as a boy and growing into his teenage years, I think Bobby just became Bobby. And, you know, Bobby has a strong ego, has strong ambitions of his own. He's not the kind of, you know, he would be a hard older brother to have. Mm-hmm. And I think it was hard for Reese from the beginning, because Bobby wasn't a protecting, you know, supportive. You know, he was just a difficult older brother to have in a lot of ways. And it just got worse and worse once they started, you know, once they were in business with their dad, the differences they had, the differences of opinion that they had over how the parent company should be handled. And then when they both separated, there were really hard feelings about how those separations took place. I mean, Reese was very upset with the way Bobby had taken advantage of his dad when he went out on his own. And then it just continues. I mean, they've sued each other a number of times, and they don't really have anything to do with one another at all. And that made my book very challenging, you know, because here I am in the middle of the two of them trying to write an objective, you know, third-party account of their father's life, and I can't really tell that story without telling the story of the whole family. And somehow I've got to walk the tightrope between, you know, two very talented and experienced men in their field, but somehow I have to be able to work with both of them and get them to both help me understand what their father's life was about and understand what's going on in the family. So it was by far the most difficult book, you know, I've ever written. And there are people that know a bit about the Jones stories, either because they're golf writers or fellow golf architects, who have sort of said to me in private they just never thought a book like this could ever get done. That, you know, there had been earlier attempts, and the problems dealing with Bobby and Reese on a project like this, or, you know, some people felt were just insurmountable. And somehow, some way, I was able to do it. I could write a book about writing the book, honestly.
Wow.
The stories that I could tell. You know, maybe someday I'll
That's why you're here, my friend. I want the stories.
Yeah. Well, there are some real stories.
And do you write as you're doing your research, or do you combine, do all your due diligence and gather all the information, throw it down, and start writing at that point?
Yeah, it's kind of a combination of the two. Certainly when you're writing, you know, the writing process shows you where you have gaps in the story that you need to fill in. So, you know, I often have to pause, you know, and reconsider and go back and find more documents, or call, you know, somebody up, that's call one of the brothers up, or call, you know, a key figure that was important to the book is a man named Roger Rulich, who was who worked for Mr. Jones from 1961 into the mid 90s when he was let go. And so he worked as Jones's chief junior designer for 30 years, and of course worked with the brothers closely for a long time, and is a friend of Reese's, not so much a friend of Bobby. So there would be times when, you know, a question about a golf course came up, and I would get on the phone and call Roger up in Massachusetts and ask him if he could answer this or that. So it's kind of an ongoing thing. You start with a base of research, and I spent 3 summers in Cornell going through what really is a massive collection. I mean, it's equivalent to, like, if you had 300 file cabinet drawers stuffed full of stuff, it's essentially what I had to look through. And beyond that, you know, since we're talking about an architect, you know, they have these cardboard tubes, you know, that are 6 feet long, that are full of drawings, you know, rolled up sketches and blueprints and so forth of all the different courses. Now, I didn't use those architectural drawings nearly as much as I use the regular documents. But from time to time, I would have a question about a course design and how it might have changed, and I would have to, you know, go back into the architectural drawings as well. So it's just it took you know, those 3 summers, and even then, you know, I can't say that I looked at everything. You sort of have to sample, you know, the files, and sometimes you see a file and its title is something you don't think is really going to help you much, and so you might skip that one. But, you know, I suppose if you say here's 100% of the Jones material, I suppose I looked at 80% of it, you know, and hopefully the 20% that I didn't look at, you know, either somebody else can make use of it someday, or it really wasn't you know, that vital to me telling the story. I mean, it's a 500-page book anyway, so, you know, more research would have just resulted in more pages.
So from the time you decided to write the book until you handed the final draft to the publisher, how long a period was that?
I would say just less than 2 years.
Okay. You had a full-time job in the interim.
Well, fortunately, I had just come out of a six-year term as the director of the Honors College at Auburn. And thanks to that administrative service, I had earned a year of paid leave.
Wow.
And so the university had given me, and so I made, without that, I couldn't, the book wouldn't have been done yet. So I had a year and I work, when I start to write, you know, it can be, you know, I don't necessarily get up too early, but I had lots of nights that were till 3 and 4 in the morning. And as Doris Kearns Goodwin said, you go to bed. You know, sometimes you even dream. You know, there are things in your dreams that are related to what you're doing. Your mind is just so full of, you know, facts and questions, you know, that you're just constantly, it's constantly agitating in your mind one way or the other. And it's a very interesting process to go through, but it's also, it's somewhat torturous. You know, it really is, you know, it's a difficult, I gave up golf through most of that. I didn't.
Yeah,
have,
that's, you know, I was like, I'm thinking and listening to you explain this and saying you had a year off. But how diligent were you? How many days you just want to go, I'm just going to forget it. I'm just going to go play golf today.
There weren't many days like that for sure.
Oh, my God. You're so impressive.
Well, no, I think manic may be the word. But, you know, I kept looking down the road. I kept saying, when this book's done, I should be having a lot of opportunities. You know, hopefully getting invitations to go play some of these golf courses that I'm writing about. And so I'm hoping, and I think it's starting to happen. I'm already getting some invitations from some of the Jones clubs to come and talk about the book and do a book signing. Yeah, and I'm more than willing to come. So if you haven't contacted me yet, please do so, because I'd love to. I haven't played Hazeltine. I haven't played Belrive. You know, there's just so many Jones courses that I haven't played. And so I'm going to try to make up for some of those golf rounds I didn't get to play.
As prolific as he was, and as we established how full of himself he may have been, are there courses that he takes credit for that he shouldn't?
Huh. Well, his sons would say courses that they designed rather than him. It is interesting.
Or is it the other way around? Yeah, it's like the sons are going, no, these are ours.
Well, yeah, there's a little bit of both. I mean, at the end of the book, there's an appendix where I list all the golf courses that Jones designed or remodeled, and the trying to define which ones to use is really challenging. And what I ended up using as a criterion for that appendix was the course done under contract to Robert Trent Jones Inc. You know, that's the main company. That's the New Jersey-based company. And if it was done by Robert Trent Jones, Inc., you know, then I think it deserves to be on the list. And Roger Rulich, you know, agreed with me that that was the only sensible way to do it. Of course, doing it that way, it means that a course, say, like Eugene Country Club or the renovation that was done there or a number of courses that Bobby was involved with, you know, Bobby would have done most of the work, but it was done under contract to Robert Trent Jones, Inc. So my position is, well, they both can count them. You know, if you're counting courses, you know, if you want to do something like that, then if it's under contract to the main company, you know, in most of those cases, Mr. Jones would have done something. I mean, he would have visited the property, produced some sketches that he would have given to Bobby if we're talking about, you know, the West Coast courses or courses in Japan that they did together. He would have had some input, but he wouldn't have. He might have only visited the property once or twice, and Bobby might have been there 30 times. And so there are a number of courses that are credited to Mr. Jones that really are done by either one of his two sons or by Roger Rulich or by Cavill Robinson, who headed up Jones's European operation. I don't begrudge him those really at all. And I think maybe the most interesting crediting issue that comes up relates to Augusta National. Augusta, in the late 40s, Bobby Jones brought Trent in to do some significant remodeling of some of the holes at Augusta. Number 16, as we know it, one of the great par threes in the world, was a very different hole before Trent Jones came in and redid it. It was just a little, the tee was right behind the 15th green. There was a little creek. It wasn't a lake. There was just a little creek. And the green was on the, would have been left of where it's, it is now over that creek. It was a bad hole. Trent and the membership and the people who had been playing the Masters thought that 16 was a weak sister. And Jones comes in and redesigns that hole completely. I mean, it's his hole. He redesigns the 18th green and the mounding around it. He redesigns the 13th green. He's the one that creates the tee on 11. He changes 11 from a really a dogleg right 350-yard hole with a green where that leg that you know isn't there to the you know, he finds a tee area back to the left, turns it into a longer 400-yard par four that really kind of turns to the left and has that and the green gets extended around this lake. And what's interesting about this is Augusta National doesn't want to, it never has credited Trent Jones for the work because they don't want to take any attention away from Mackenzie or Bobby Jones. Clifford Roberts, longtime director of the club, president of the club, and director of the Masters tournament, you know, never wanted to give Trent that credit. But you know, I've got documents that are letters. I mean, I have letters from Bobby Jones to Trent Jones, which is all about this remodeling work that Trent was involved with in the late 40s and early 50s. So to me, that was more interesting than maybe. Courses that he shouldn't get credit for. Here's maybe the most famous course in the world, except for the old course at St. Andrews. And he deserves some credit that Augusta never gives him. And so, I mean, I'll be kind of interested to see what the reaction is from Augusta to what I write about this in the book. But I have undeniable documentation from in the hand of Bobby Jones himself.
Wow. Did he have a course that was his showpiece or his favorite that he would like to, you know, that he would say to people, this is mine?
Yeah, he had an answer to that every time they asked him. And the answer was the next one. His favorite is going to be the next one.
Well, yeah, it's like when someone's, to me, it's like, what is the hardest shot in golf? The next one.
Oh, he definitely had some favorites, but he, you know, he always had that one liner, you know, when to come back when anybody really asked him. But I think Spyglass was a course that he was very, very proud of out on the Monterey Peninsula. I think he was very proud of the Dunes Club down in Myrtle Beach. I mean, Myrtle Beach wasn't Myrtle Beach until. I mean, there was one course at Myrtle Beach when Jones designed the Dunes Club in the late 40s. And how many courses are there at Myrtle Beach now? I mean, well over 100, I think. So Jones is, and so that's one of his designs that is very well known. I think he's proud of Hazeltine, even though it had a lot of controversy when 70 Open was played there, and Dave Hill, you know, said call it a cow pasture, and said he would drive around in a drive a tractor onto the course if he won the tournament but I think Jones had they made some changes and he had strong feelings about Hazeltine. Bellerive in St. Louis, I think he was proud of that one. Foreign courses, I think of all the courses, maybe the course that's rated highest, there was a recent poll that the golf architects were rating golf courses around the world, and I took a real close look at that. And the very top rated golf course by Jones was Valderrama in Spain. Jones, that was where the Ryder Cup was played in 97. Mm-hmm. And before he did Valderrama on the same property, he did a course called Soto Grande. And it was the first course where American turf grass was introduced into Southern Europe. And so it's a very significant course historically. And so Soto Grande, Valderrama are certainly two of his better knowns. Mauna Kea in Hawaii, I think that's another one early on in the Hawaii popularity of Hawaii as a tourist destination. That was part of a Lawrence Rockefeller resort development. I think those are all really in the ballpark of his favorites.
Excellent. Wow. What an amazing story.
Yeah, it is. And it's going to be challenging for me as I go around the country giving talks and trying to keep it to 20 minutes if I can, how to focus it.
Yeah.
Because it is really an epic
It's an epic American story. You know, that's why I hope people will give it, will read it, that are not, maybe not even huge fans of golf or golf architecture, because it's an incredible story of an immigrant coming to America with big dreams, big ideas, and doing different things and finding ways to achieve his goals, but at a price, always at a price.
Yeah, and big is an understatement.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
Well, the name of the book is A Difficult Par, Robert Trent Jones Sr. and the Making of Modern Golf by James R. Hansen, also the author of First Man, The Life of Neil Armstrong. What a dichotomy of going left to right on that one. That's amazing. Jim, thank you so much for your time and for the explanation and for your work here. This is spectacular, and I hope that I get together with you in Alabama and play some golf.
You call me anytime, Fred.
Well, thank you so much. And I want to make sure that everybody is aware that the book and the ebook are going to be available in the Golfer's Mart at golfsmarter.com. Jim, thanks a lot.
You bet. Thank you very much.
Now, as I publish this show on May 13, the book is being released today. Both the hardcover and digital versions of A Difficult Par, Robert Trent Jones Sr. and the Making of Modern Golf by New York Times bestselling author James R. Hansen, H-A-N-S-E-N, is available in the book section of our Golfer's Mart. At the beginning of each episode, you hear this little audio billboard for smarterpodcasts.com. Golf Smarter is not the only podcast that I produce. I'm happy to announce that the all-new smarterpodcasts.com is now live and ready for you to check out. I want to thank Paul Matsuda, a longtime Golf Smarter listener and now friend, who did a great job on re-imaging the site, and he also just completed our main site at greencreative.com. So please check them both out. Pay him a visit. If you use Twitter, follow us at Golf Smarter. Hashtag sound advice. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.